And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Bob Costas is a legend in sports broadcasting, and not just because of the brilliance and elegance with which he's called the games, but because of his honest, thoughtful, and incisive perspective that he's brought to the institution of sports. After 40 years at NBC, Costas is now a commentator at CNN, and I checked in with him last week on this turbulent year in sports, in politics, and in the life of our country. Here's that conversation. Bob Costas, it's great to see you, a living legend with your Syracuse cap on, a faithful alum.
The cradle of sports broadcasters.
I know.
I can't even keep track of the dozens and dozens. I mean, it started with the legendary Marty Glickman, who was...
I know. I was going to ask you, we both grew up in New York, and you were a New York Giants fan. You know, my father and I used to drive to Coney Island. We would park our car. He would park the car. We would get hot dogs at Nathan's. And those big fat French fries, and we would sit in the car and listen to Marty Glickman and Al DeRogatis call the Giants games on Sundays.
And Marty also virtually invented how a basketball game should be called on the radio. Head of the key, he invented that. It seems, you know, second nature now. Swish was his call, and then his protege Marv Albert came up with yes. So I read in a Knicks yearbook when I was a junior in high school that Marty and Marv Albert had both gone to Syracuse. And so that was good enough for me. And they actually had a communication school. Most universities had a journalism school then, print journalism, but very few focused on broadcasting. That was kind of looked like, oh, that's not really an academic lane. Now virtually every university has one. But I think Syracuse and a handful of others, Northwestern, Missouri, a few others, are kind of at the top of that list. And once we began to build sort of an alumni core, Marty, Marv, Dick Stockton, Ted Koppel, an outlier because he wasn't a sports broadcaster, myself, Len Berman, then everybody just was drawn to it. So now you've got Ian Eagle and Sean McDonough and Mike Tirico, and there's probably 50 of us running around virtually controlling the sports broadcasting industry.
Yeah, it's incredible. I want to talk to you about your journey in sports broadcasting in a second, but one of the things that distinguishes you and has always distinguished you is that you're a very incisive observer and commentator on the institution of sports itself, and you've treated it that way, not just the game, though we love the games, but sports itself. And it seems like sports, the sports world has been enmeshed in the twin kind of crises that we've faced this year. First, you know, the pandemic is obviously something that's controlled so much of what's happened with sports, and then the social justice movement around George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, and how that's impacted on sports, all intertwined with the presidential race because the president comments periodically on these issues in his, you know, through the prism of his own politics. But tell me how sports faring in all of this? How has the sports world been changed by what we've faced this year as a country?
I think it's a mixed bag. First of all, as you said, they've had to deal with COVID. And it looks like baseball somehow is going to complete this tightrope walk from one end of the ravine to the other. It looked for a while when there was an outbreak with the Marlins and then with the Cardinals that maybe they couldn't make it. I have to give them credit from the commissioner's office on down through everyone employed by teams. And it looks like they'll get through it and they'll have some semblance of a season. When we look at the ratings for everything, the ratings are down from what they were. And there's multiple factors at play here. People's habits have been changed. We might have thought, well, they're all at home, so the ratings will go up. They have nothing else to watch. But who knows how this has affected what people do and the normal rhythms of their lives. Plus, television ratings have been affected by streaming and multiple options.
Yeah. So Netflix has had a big boon here. So and they don't carry sports.
You're not comparing apples to apples necessarily, right, even when we talk about the recent past. But some of it, when we talk about the NFL and especially the NBA, some of it, and Commissioner Adam Silver of the NBA acknowledges this, some of it has to do with alienation by at least a portion of their fan base, who knows what portion, many of whom are in disagreement with the social justice messages. Others are in general agreement with it, but don't want to be confronted with it every time they watch a game. So starting next year, I think Silver and other commissioners look at it as this was a moment of, in time. As you said, it's a confluence of incredible circumstances. COVID, the economy, social justice, a presidential election, and with a particularly provocative incumbent putting out statements on a constant basis that stoke flames. So beyond this moment, I think they all realize, yeah, players should have a voice, but this is also a business. It's also entertainment. And a lot of us have a stake in it, including the players. So how do we navigate this going forward? And from my recent conversation on CNN with Adam Silver, I think the notion is give these players every platform. Forgive me for going on here. I'll try and be
I want you to go on.
Give these players every platform. You know, in recent years, every league has its own network. There's an MLB network, an NHL network, an NFL network, an NBA network. It seems to me that they could make a portion of each week, a couple of hours each week, whatever it is, make it available for players to express themselves beyond bumper stickers, beyond kneeling. Let's see what you think with some nuance and at some length with informed moderators. Let's get those voices out there. And you can certainly use pregame, postgame. I don't think most people object if Ernie Johnson and Charles Barkley and Shaq and Kenny Smith are talking about social justice on the pregame show or the postgame show.
They've had some moving conversations about it.
They really have. Some of it's been profound and poignant. But I think that they're going to have to find a balance. And by saying that, that doesn't mean that I'm in any way hostile to the social justice messages. I think you got to take it case by case. And now I'll say this, which some people will regard as heresy. I think all of us who've been around a little while ought to be able to make reasonable distinctions. And so even if I'm in basic sympathy with a cause or an idea, that doesn't mean I have to regard every ball player with a Twitter account as if he's Frederick Douglass in Nikes. Some of what's said is on the money. Some of what's said, even if the intentions are good, does not align with the facts, or it's too sweeping, it's too broad. LeBron James is well-intended and he's done some very good things. I don't necessarily agree with every sweeping statement he's made.
I think back to, it was 1990 when Harvey Gantt ran against Jesse Helms in North Carolina. It was a historic race. He was the black mayor of Charlotte and a veteran of the civil rights movement running against essentially a segregationist. And Michael Jordan was asked to get involved, and he famously said, or was quoted as having said, look, Republicans wear gym shoes too.
Yeah, in Michael's defense, not that he needs me to defend him, supposedly, and this was seen on the Last Dance documentary this summer on ESPN, supposedly he said that largely in jest on the team bus after a practice when someone was chiding him, and that was just his comeback. But when you look at that situation, Michael Jordan being who he was, and he's from North Carolina, and this was clear cut. This was Harvey Gantt, African-American, against Jesse Helms. Why sugarcoat it? A racist, a virulent segregationist, a racist who whistled Dixie when black people got on the congressional elevator, who used an obvious appeal to racist tendencies, a white guy's hand, and then a black guy's hand comes in and snatches away the job application. This was a moral question, more so than a political question. And I think that Michael whiffed on that one. But that one alone, having said, even in this moment, I don't think that anyone needs to feel compelled to do what just doesn't fit for them. Yeah. Not every person is politically inclined.
Well, so, the other question is, you know, I watched Michael Jordan for 13 seasons in Chicago. It was the greatest gift I've ever gotten. I told my young sons then, you guys, you got to watch this because you'll never see this again. He is the Babe Ruth of basketball.
Yes.
And it was a joy. And I so appreciated him. But my feeling was, I don't watch him for his political views. I don't watch him for, you know, guidance about how I should live my life or how I should think. I watch him because he's the greatest basketball player of all time. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy the hell out of watching him. In some ways, I admire these young men for speaking out because they're speaking through the lens of their own experience. And they're speaking they're giving voice to the experience that other people have. And when prominent people stand up, NBA players or people in other realms, and say, you know what, I've experienced this. Mm-hmm. Systemic racism is not a myth. I've lived it. I've been rousted by police and so on. I think that's powerful. But I think we expect too much in certain ways of these young people. And I'm not sure that that's entirely right. And, you know, look, it's in other realms as well. You know, I'm sort of, I appreciate that so many people in Hollywood want to speak out. It's not always particularly constructive. And sometimes it's not always
perfectly well informed. Everyone's entitled to their opinion, but not every opinion should carry equal weight, even if the intentions are good. But as I said earlier, I think this is a moment in time because of the confluence of all these circumstances. And then we'll see a different approach going forward, which is not to say that these issues should be pushed to the back burner, but there might be a different approach in addressing them.
It was interesting. We saw a little microcosm of this when, you know, this tension between the business of sports and these moral issues that arise in public life, when the general manager of the Houston Rockets spoke out about human rights abuses in China, which is a big partner of the NBA. Mm-hmm. And it was a terribly awkward position for the league. And you saw a lot of players and, you know, prominent progressive voices in the league sort of step back and say, I'm not down for this, which was interesting to me. So there is that balancing of interests. And I guess that came to the fore when the players, during, I guess it was either before or during the playoffs, when the NBA players, based on an event, decided that maybe they wouldn't continue with the season. Mm-hmm. Was it Breonna Taylor? I can't remember what it was that provoked that. But LeBron.
No, I think it was the Blake shooting in
Kenosha. Oh, it was the Blake shooting. It was
the
Blake shooting.
Because the Milwaukee
yes.
Bucks are obviously the Kenosha. That would be the team in
yes,
near
right,
Milwaukee,
right.
Not
yes.
that far from Kenosha. And just before the scheduled tip off against the Orlando Magic, they walked off, and there was some thought that maybe the whole thing would stop at that point. But Adam Silver and his predecessor David Stern as well, they have the most constructive relationship with their players, I think, of the four leagues, and the greatest amount of trust, and they figured out a way to navigate it. But a point that should be obvious here is when that happened, or when I think it was the Marlins and the Mets walked off before the scheduled start of the game at Citi Field, and they put a Black Lives Matter t-shirt on home plate, that was very moving. But remember, no fans in the stands. No
right.
one had bought tickets and schlepped to the ballpark or to the arena. So again, this is a moment in time thing. Imagine if that had happened. Imagine if the Bucks had done that in front of a packed house. The reaction to that might have boomeranged on them. So again, I'm repeating myself, the issues will remain and they should be addressed. But how they're addressed most effectively probably takes a different form going forward.
Yeah, we saw that in the opening game of the NFL season, because there were there were 17,000 or something fans
yeah.
in Kansas City. The two teams engaged in a symbolic act of protest. And there were fans who were booing in the
yeah.
stands. I guess there's some confusion about exactly what happened.
Were they
there.
Booing the Texans, the opposing team to the Chiefs,
yes.
or were they booing the demonstration? You know, going back to your earlier point, though, David, about China, the NBA was in a very awkward position. And some people appeared to be hypocritical because not only did they not speak out or support Daryl Morey, the general manager of the Rockets, but they backed away and almost like, hey, you shouldn't talk about this. The NBA took an All-Star game out of North Carolina because North Carolina had some sort of law that prohibited transgender bathrooms or mm-hmm. whatever. I'm not saying that's not an issue, but as a human rights issue, compare that with, you want to talk about systemic oppression?
Yeah.
That's what China's about.
Yes.
China's one of the largest, maybe given its size and its influence, the greatest human rights abuser on the planet. Okay, so when Adam Silver said, and I respect him greatly, but when he said, we're not going to sanction Daryl Morey because free speech is a core value of the NBA, okay, fine. Isn't human rights a core value of the NBA? Isn't that what Black Lives Matter is about? So, you know, sometimes you can drive yourself into a cul-de-sac on these
yeah.
things. How do you get out with any kind of consistency?
Yeah.
I found myself in some, not awkward, but when you take a nuanced position sometimes, or you make distinctions in this atmosphere, people want you to be, it's binary. High, low, yes,
yes
no,
yes,
up,
yes.
down, good, bad. So you take Colin Kaepernick. 3 years ago, I know I was the first sportscaster of any prominence, and certainly the first and maybe only network sports broadcaster. In 2017, I said on CNN, obviously, he's being blackballed. And I made the distinction between a peaceful protest that apparently incited all kinds of negative reaction from many NFL fans, but at the same time, those fans aren't going to be protesting or taking to Twitter or complaining on right-wing talk radio when their team signs a guy with a criminal record. You know, Pac-Man Jones went from team to team when it's one of the leading miscreants in NFL history, but if he could return punts for touchdowns, people didn't seem to mind it as much as they minded Colin Kaepernick. Okay, and I get that Kaepernick is in some sense part of a long tradition, Smith and Carlos, and
yes.
even back to Jack Johnson and Muhammad Ali,
Muhammad
Jackie
Ali,
Robinson
yeah.
and Arthur
yeah.
Ashe.
Yes, yes,
yes. But Colin Kaepernick also said, I don't vote because the oppressor will never allow you to vote your way out of your oppression. When he said that, Barack Obama was president. He continued mm-hmm. to say it, and Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton. John Lewis recently died. Among his many heroic acts was that he was willing to put his safety, maybe his life,
and
on
did,
the line.
Did time
secure,
after time.
Secure
yeah.
that right. You know, Colin Kaepernick wore socks that depicted cops, not rogue cops, but all cops, as pigs. When they played the Dolphins in Miami, he extolled Fidel Castro. How does that play with the Cuban community in Florida? So I reserve the right to say, look, Colin Kaepernick did a good thing as far as this goes. But I don't put Colin Kaepernick in the same category as Arthur Ashe or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and others. I just don't find him to be that thoughtful a voice.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about those because I think, yeah, there is this sense that this is new. It's not new. What is new is the collective action
mm-hmm.
that is being taken by players. But, you know, when you and I were young, we witnessed in another time of great turbulence and activism, pretty heroic and striking acts of activism. Ali, who I want to talk to you about because I know you've said he is the most that when he lit the torch at the Olympics,
yeah.
it was the greatest moment of your broadcast career. I think he was the most luminescent sports figure of that time and maybe of all time in some ways. But he gave up the prime of his career to make a statement that was, you know, really profound. And paid quite a bit for that.
When he wouldn't step forward and accept
to be inducted,
the draft,
yeah, yeah,
yeah, be inducted, he put his entire career on the line. As it was, he missed 3+ years. For all he knew, there was a possibility, at least, that he would go to jail. There was also a significant possibility that he would never be able to resume his career. And when he did, even though he still became champion again and did wondrous things, he was never the fighter he once was.
Right.
You know, the shelf life of an athlete's prime is relatively short. He was unlike any other heavyweight boxer ever, with his agility and speed and the way he fought. And he was not the same fighter when he came back. So yeah. He put a whole lot more on the line than even Colin Kaepernick did. Colin Kaepernick lost his NFL career, yeah. But there was a fallback with Nike and other things. So, and also with Ali, you got to keep this in mind. And this matters. Colin Kaepernick was good enough to take his team to the Super Bowl and almost win it once. But Colin Kaepernick's not Tom Brady. He's right. not Peyton Manning. He's not Russell Wilson. Muhammad Ali was the greatest yeah. of all time. Not only was he the heavyweight champion of the world, but he was so beautiful and so entertaining. Even yeah. people who despised his politics had to find him entertaining when he was with yeah. Howard Cosell or with Johnny Carson or whatever. So he was uniquely equipped as a person, and his platform being what it was, and the tone of the times, where the racism was even more stark and obvious, the tone of the times, all those factors came together in a way that was unique to Ali. And also keep in mind, his sport was an individual sport, yeah. not a team sport. And for whatever this may be worth, you saw Muhammad always praying before the opening bell. And he almost always, when Howard Cosell or whomever would interview him after the victory, he would mention Allah. But when the ring girl, and that's a retro idea and they still exist, yes. when the ring girl came out holding up a placard that said round three, it didn't contain a social justice message. So right. even if you, whether you loved Ali, disliked him or whatever, you could watch the fight as a fight. I remember the first Ali Frazier fight in March of 1971 at Madison Square Garden, one of the most electric sports events ever.
Yeah.
And it was freighted with all kinds of political and cultural meaning. That's what gave it, that and the fact that it was the two greatest heavyweights and the contrast in styles. But you could watch the fight just as an extraordinary sports event. Was it freighted with all these other overtones? Of course it was. But during the fight itself, what you might have been thinking about it, but that wasn't being put in front of you. The commentators yeah. weren't talking about it. So it could stand alone as a sports event, and then we could talk about it before and afterwards as a cultural event, because it was both.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. I want to talk to you about you, because you have your own interesting story. And let's go back to the beginning of it. You grew up first on Long Island. Where are the Costases from originally?
Well, originally, I was born in Queens.
Not your kind. I mean, I'm talking about way back.
Oh,
your family.
Well, the father's side, Greece. Uh-huh. They were Ellis Island people. My dad was the last of eight children. He was actually born posthumously. His father died of a heart attack in 1927 on a subway car in New York. And my dad was born shortly after that. His mom didn't speak all that much English. Eight kids, six boys, two girls. They all grew up to be successful in their own ways. They were an extremely colorful family. My mom's side, mostly Irish and a combination of other things. My dad was a very colorful man.
Yeah.
Mentioned in other places, he was an inveterate gambler, and that often created some trauma within
inveterate
the home.
Sounds like a euphemism. It sounds like he was a compulsive gambler.
He was, David. He was a compulsive gambler, and while he made a good living for a guy in the late 50s and through the 60s.
He was an electrical engineer.
Yeah, he was an electrical engineer. He's a very smart guy. He could build a house if you gave him the materials. He could build a house on his own or take a car apart and rebuild it. And I had none of those tendencies. But what we had in common was sports. And he almost always had a lot of money riding on games. I mean, whether we could pay the mortgage on time was often riding on whether Whitey Ford could get Al Kaline out or Wilt Chamberlain could make a couple of free throws, which was always dicey in Wilt's case.
Yes.
And my mom and sister often fled the house. They went to my grandmother's house. But I would always stick around. And remember, this is the 60s. I would sometimes, he'd have me climb up on the roof and spin the antenna around, the television antenna on the roof. We're on Long Island, and we're trying to pick up the Red Sox game, which might have been on TV in Hartford, or the Phillies. And he'd be sticking his head out the window, a little more, up, 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 right there, that's good, that's it. We'd come back in, or he would send me out to the car, where radio reception was better than in the house. If he had a bet on the Cardinals against the Reds, I'd be fiddling with the car.
You could pick up KMOX on the island.
It worked. Yeah. Right out of college, I went to KMOX, a station I'd listened to as a kid through the crackle and static, or WWL in Cincinnati. So I would not only be looking for the score, but I would hear Harry Carey and Jack Buck on the Cardinals. And I hear Wade Coit, who was a teammate of Babe Ruth's.
Yes.
He was the announcer for the Reds.
Yes.
And so the styles of the announcers kind of seeped in by osmosis. And then I'd run back in the house and report to my dad in my fledgling play-by-play style.
And did you guys go to games?
Yes. Yeah, we went to games. One in particular, I could give you hundreds of stories, but my dad took me with him when he met his bookie at a donut shop.
Yeah, because we should point out, he wasn't borrowing. He wasn't borrowing money from household finance here. He was
right.
He was dealing with guys who would eat people up and chew them and spit them out for not paying their debts.
He actually knew guys named Fury and Three Finger. And one time, a car pulls up on a Sunday afternoon in the summer in the driveway. There's two cars in the driveway, so it's pretty clear that the family is at home. And he tells me, I'm like 12, he tells me, go to the door, tell them I'm not home. And here's a guy in a suit, looked like Central Casting Sentiment, snap brim hat, pinky ring, suit on a sweltering July day.
Size 18 and a half collar.
Right, pretty much. And, you know, an adult is a little softer with a kid. And I remember, I opened the door. Yeah, John home? No, he isn't here. When will he be back? I don't know. Well, tell him Nunzio was here. I swear, tell him Nunzio was here. What am I, in The Godfather? Because The Godfather even existed? So now here it is. I was 14 in this case. It was 1966. And we go to this donut shop, and my dad was up. He was on a huge winning streak. And bookies don't mind that. It's all business to them. In the long run, they're going to win.
Right.
They take 10% extra when they win. The odds are tilted in their favor at all times. So I'm sitting there, and the guy slides a paper bag across the counter to my dad after saying, hey, that your boy? Nice boy. Give the kid a glass of milk and a donut. That was an awfully large gesture on your part. So now we go out. We go out to the car, and underneath a streetlight in Brooklyn, he counts out $14,000 in $100 bills. It's probably more than the annual income of the people who lived on either side of us in 1966. And then he says, hey, the Knicks are playing, Robert. Let's go to the Garden. Now, that might have been, in many ways, a traumatic youth. And it was in many ways, because he was volatile and he got angry and holidays.
And you had to move. You had to move. And I guess part of the motivation may have been he needed to get away from those debts, huh?
Yeah. In 1960, we abruptly moved. I was 8 years old. We abruptly moved from Long Island to California. And back then, I guess it was harder to trace people. There's no internet. You could disappear and start over. And I learned afterwards that we were fleeing a debt. And then we came back east about 2 years after that. Now, a lot of people would consider that, you know, as use the word again, a traumatic childhood.
Yeah.
And I won't deny it. In many ways, it was. But I also looked at my father as an interesting and romantic figure. He was more interesting than, you know, the suburbanites of that era who mowed their lawn every Saturday.
Yes,
morning.
He wasn't Dick Van Dyke. So were you frightened? I mean, did you fear at times that something might happen to him?
A little, but more I feared what his fits of temper and the emotional swings would do to our family. It was hard on all of us. It was especially hard on my mother and my sister, because in a strange way, all this stuff attached me to my dad, because I liked sports to begin with, and mm-hmm. this was the way that he and I connected. We didn't have all that much in common otherwise. I remember him sometimes coming home from work, usually it would be on a Friday with the weekend looming, and he'd bring a model airplane or something like that that I was supposed to put together, which I couldn't do for the life of me. And I had to feign excitement about it, but I had no aptitude for it. Mm-hmm. But the sports part really, really connected us. And going to ball games, going to the old Yankee Stadium, that kind of stuff. You know, I remember that vividly.
I read some of your comments about baseball. And my father was an immigrant. And he came in, I think he learned how to play baseball, came to the Bronx before he learned how to speak English. And he played sandlot ball with Hank Greenberg.
Wow.
He became an all-city pitcher. He got a scholarship to Long Island University to pitch. And, you know, every weekend, my parents were split up. Every weekend, we would just spend at the ballpark, you know. And the best days were doubleheaders, obviously, on Sunday. And, you know, you said people don't understand the generational element of this. I think baseball is so underappreciated for that reason, and because you go to I have this argument with my wife all the time, who's a great basketball fan and can't stand baseball. She's boring, slow. I said, no, you go to a basketball game, you go to a football game, you go to a hockey game. When you go to a baseball game, you say, I'm going to the ballpark.
Right.
I'm going to the ballpark. It's a park. It's not just about the game. The game is beautiful, but it's the experience. And, you know, to me, I link it back to my dad, as you probably do to yours.
And, you know, of all the great literature and commentary there's been over the decades about baseball, and there's been a lot of it, if you want to just grasp the essence, I don't think you can do better than the 4 or 5 minutes of George Carlin's brilliant monologue about the difference between baseball and football. George was a master of language, and of nuanced out-of-the-box perspective, and he brought it all together right there.
So you went to the car, you heard all these announcers, and you named some of the great ones. Were there announcers first of all, why was that so entrancing to you? And secondly, who are the ones who you thought, yeah, I could see myself doing that. I want to be like that.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't separate the voices who brought me the games from the games themselves. And I don't think I was alone in this. If I was shooting baskets by myself in the driveway or in the schoolyard, or throwing a tennis ball or a rubber ball, which we in New York called a Spalding, even though it was made by Spalding.
Yes, I remember
or
well.
Or a Pensy Pinky.
Exactly.
Throwing that off the stoop. You know, I'm playing an imaginary game.
We're playing stickball.
Yeah. Stickball or whatever in the street. I was hearing Mel Allen or Red Barber. Yeah. Or I was hearing Marty Glickman on the Knicks or on the Giants in football. And then those 2 years that I mentioned earlier, which we spent in California, I listened to Vin Scully. I was one of those apparently millions who snuck the transistor radio under the pillow. My parents thought I was asleep. And I'm listening to Vin Scully call the Dodgers. And that's where the notion took hold with me that a baseball game, especially all sports events, but a baseball game has a melody. It isn't just a nuts and bolts narration. It has a melody. And Scully, of course, was the absolute.
What a joy to listen to him call a game.
Yeah.
You know, even today, you know, there are some great, we in Chicago, Pat Hughes is a play-by-play man there.
Very good.
Yeah, I mean, he creates a picture for you that you can see. You know,
that's
his
right.
words are so descriptive. And I always appreciate that he starts the games off by saying, introducing himself and saying, Pat Hughes reporting, you know.
Because it's a throwback.
Yeah, it is a throwback. But I want to go back. I don't know if you've ever listened to Reagan call Cubs games off
of
ticker. But he must have brought a little of that theatrics to that.
Yeah, he was on WHO in Des Moines calling Cub games, and most of those games were recreations where the bare bones facts of what had happened came over a ticker tape. And the broadcaster and maybe the engineer are sitting in a studio somewhere with rudimentary sound effects. A stick hit against a block of wood was the crack of the bat. little bit of artificial crowd sound, which you're hearing now on games with no fans. That
exactly
creating that. And maybe if they were especially creative, some peanuts, popcorn, you know, that whole thing. And then what becomes legendary is the ticker tape breaks down. And Reagan or whomever has just said, it's a beautiful sunny day at Wrigley Field. Now the ticker tape breaks down and they have to all of a sudden have a storm move in from out of nowhere. Now there's a rain delay until we can resume, or a dog runs on the field, or a guy fouls off 10 consecutive pitches until the ticker tape resumes and we find out he grounded out to shortstop. But radio is that whole theater of the mind, that whole imagination thing. And I've always felt that if you first mastered radio, much easier to go to television and just write captions under the picture than it is to go from television to radio and figure out how you're going to paint the whole picture on a blank canvas.
So tell me about how you went to Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And there's some historical dispute as to whether you actually graduated from Syracuse or not, because you became a professional broadcaster while you were a student at Syracuse.
Yeah, there shouldn't be any dispute because I've never said otherwise. I left a few credits shy of graduation. What happened was, just before my senior year, I got a job broadcasting minor league hockey in the old Eastern League, the actual league that the Paul Newman movie Slapshot was based on. In fact, I knew a lot of the players who were extras in the movie. So I'm doing these games, and I decided, well, I got to cut back on my credit load. So I cut back from 15 to 9 credits in both the fall and in the spring. So what would have been my class graduated in the spring of 1974, and then it was my intention to enroll again in the fall semester, continue doing these hockey games, and finish up my degree. But then, lo and behold, I lucked out again, and I got hired by KMOX in St. Louis, and I don't think anyone in my position would have done anything different. I left and took the job in St. Louis at one of the premier radio stations of all time. Jack Buck, the Hall of Fame voice of the Cardinals, Joe Buck's dad. Jack was the sports director there, and they had a whole roster of wonderful sports broadcasters. To join that group and to learn from them in that environment, I've never regretted that decision.
Well, and here's my question for you.
He's an honorary alum anyways.
Yeah, I mean, for crying out loud, for all you've done for Syracuse University and in broadcasting, give you the goddamn credits, for crying out loud.
Well, you know what they did? They skipped right over the bachelor's degree and the master's degree. They gave me an honorary doctorate.
Well, that's good. Well, that makes up for it.
What the hell?
You went there to call games in the old ABA, the St. Louis Spirits. Did they play at the Checker Dome there? Is that where they played?
Wow, you're on it. Yes, they did. Was called at various times the St. Louis Arena. Then Ralston Purina briefly owned the St. Louis Blues, the hockey team. So then it became the Checker Dome. We played there. We lasted for 2 seasons, and then the ABA folded, or it was absorbed by the NBA, and they only wanted to take 4 teams. They took the Pacers, the Nuggets, the Spurs, and the Nets. They wanted the Nets not only because of the market, but because Dr. J, who was the symbol of the ABA, played for the Nets, and soon enough they traded him, or some other deal was worked out, and he wound up with the 76ers. But the Spirits disappeared after those 2 seasons. They were 2 very colorful seasons.
So that must have been fun. You were, what, 22, 23?
I was 22. I looked like I was 15. So that experience, and then the wild days of the ABA. By the time I was 24, the most colorful experiences of my entire career had come and gone. Nothing since then. A lot of things have been great and wonderful, but nothing since then matched it for sheer lunacy. The Eastern Hockey League and the old ABA, just for antics and absurdity, that was at the top of the list.
What was it like to be like such a young guy in that? You named a whole bunch of sports legends who worked at KMOX. And, you know, you were, as you point out, you were young and you looked younger. You still look young. What was it like? How it must have been heady. Did you ever just sort of say, what the hell am I doing here?
Yes.
And did they ever say, what the hell are you doing here?
Both. And I think the best way to explain it is this. Joe Buck is immensely talented. And anyone who thinks he's where he is because of his dad is nuts. The door opened because of his dad. But then he barged through it because of his talent. But Joe was around it from the time that he was a little kid. So I think I rubbed some people unintentionally. I rubbed them the wrong way. Even though I revered Jack Buck and Dan Kelly, the legendary voice of the St. Louis Blues, and others who were there, I revered them, but I think that I was trying to compensate. They might have thought I was brash. I guess I was pretty good for 22, some precocious ability. And I think it took a while before I kind of reached some state of equanimity about it all. And then, you know, over time, everything resolves itself, and they felt, I would think, as positively about me as I did about them.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You went on, I guess, first to CBS and then to NBC, and you call all kinds of sports.
Yeah.
You did do baseball. One of the people who you got to know who was your boyhood hero, and I grew up in New York, and I know what an awesome sports figure he was there, was Mickey Mantle. You became so close, you ended up delivering the eulogy at his funeral. Talk a little bit about him. You know, Mickey Mantle was like the sort of symbol of, you know, sports. He was sort of like Superman in New York.
He was.
At his prime. But he was a troubled guy. I mean, I always wonder how good a player Mickey Mantle could have been if he wasn't drinking and carrying on.
Yeah, he himself wondered about that. In fairness to him, he had osteomyelitis from a football injury in high school. Then he rips up his knee stepping on an exposed drain in Yankee Stadium when he's just a rookie. Oddly enough, talk about a convergence. A fly ball to right field hit by the rookie Willie Mays. Joe DiMaggio in his last season comes over from center field. Mantle is playing right. DiMaggio and Mantle converge on the ball hit by Willie Mays. And Mantle's knee is ripped up. Now, with advanced surgical techniques, it might not have been such a bad thing, but it troubled him throughout his career, and he had other injuries. And in fairness, and I knew Mickey well, the extreme alcoholism really took hold after he retired. He wasn't the only ball player who drank. Players did not have the same sort of fitness and nutrition regimens and all the rest that they do now. The injuries were more significant, but certainly the late night carousing and whatnot didn't help. And he lived from 1969 on, when he retired, until his death in 1995, in deep regret about a number of things. But from a baseball standpoint, as great as he was, first ballot Hall of Famer, no question, he felt he could have been greater. And without getting too baseball nerdy here on you, I think a lot of younger people who take a look just at the statistics say, well, sure, he was a great player. He was a Hall of Famer, no doubt, but not as great as the mythology. But they have to look at it from the 10 or 12 year chunk when he was close to at his best. Right during that period of time, he was right there with his great contemporaries, Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, but they sustained longer, to their credit. So their careers were greater overall. But at his peak, if you lived through it, you understood why there was an ongoing Mantle Mays debate. It was like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson.
Yes.
They were very close to equals.
Yeah. Well, look, he had everything. He had speed. He had prodigious power.
Yeah.
He was an awesome player. I did read the story of him thinking that he wasn't going to play and coming to the ballpark after having spent a long night out. Maybe the night was still going on when he got to the ballpark. And then coming in and pinch hitting and hitting a home run. And one of his teammates asked him how he could do that. He said, well, I saw three balls and I just swung at the middle one.
It's colorful, right?
Who are the other people who you've covered who have made an impact on you? You mentioned Ali.
Yeah.
You were... I don't know if you interacted with him while he was still active as a boxer.
No, I came a bit later, but I did come to know him I took my kids to visit him at his home that was on, I'm not so great on the geography here, but it was on a lake on the Michigan border.
Yeah.
And it was a house that previously had belonged to Al Capone.
Yeah.
And it had an escape route, like out the back door. It was on the lake. Capone used to have a motorboat there. So just in case he had to escape either rival gangsters or the feds or whatever, he could hop in the motorboat going out the back of the house and disappear across the lake. So what's the
in irony? Case Nunzio shows up.
Right.
You
right.
have to have that.
So,
yes.
Muhammad Ali living in Al Capone's house. And so I did get to know him very well. And of course, I was the host of the Olympics in 96
yes.
when he lit the torch, which was one of the great moments that I've ever experienced in or out of sports. And so and we did a documentary within it called Twice Born, because Ali himself said that he felt that that was the moment of reconciliation and the moment where his status as sort of a world ambassador of goodwill and peace came together and was solidified. I had a relationship with Muhammad and attended his memorial service in Louisville. His family, his wife Lonnie, they've always been very kind to me, and I was part of trying to raise the funds for the Muhammad Ali Museum, which is awesome in Louisville. So I had that relationship. And the larger answer to your question is this, David. Is Michael Jordan incredible? Of course. Was I privileged to be around him? Of course. We talk about present day athletes. Is Tom Brady maybe the best of all time? He sure is. Or Mike Trout with the Angels. But no one can have the same effect on you as people you grew up watching.
Mm-hmm.
So Mantle, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell and Jerry West and Oscar Robertson. These are the people that I grew up watching. And then pinch yourself. Here I am. They know me by name. I'm interviewing them. That has a different effect. I mean, think of it this way. If you were a kid, someone of our age, okay, and let's say you're a Yankee fan for the sake of argument, you meet Mickey Mantle, and the next day you meet Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter's wonderful, classy, great, first-level Hall of Famer. Not going to have the same effect on
right.
you. You didn't watch Derek Jeter when you were 10.
One of the great benefits of working in the White House is I got to have lunch with Bill Russell, got to meet Sandy Koufax. Ernie Banks came by, and we had a great discussion about why no one was in Willie Mays' class, which I thought was in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, you're right. You're totally right. You also, as time went on, you know, much as you've been here, you used your platform. You said what you thought. At times, you probably made the network uncomfortable. Talk a little bit about that. What, you know?
Well, a couple of things here. And I appreciate having the time to be a little bit more expansive. Contrary to what gets out there, and you know, in a social media world, certain ideas get out there and they're repeated often enough. And even people who think they're being fair-minded accept them as true. So this notion that Costas, I really liked Costas, but then everything became political with him. 99% of what I did, not just overall in my career, but in the last 10 years, was about the game or about the event. And I never talked about these issues, unless it was parenthetically, never talked about these issues during the game or during the event. But I was most often the host of the football coverage or the Olympic coverage. So there were little windows in between when stuff wasn't directly going on. I would never do any of this stuff when Michael Phelps was about to jump in the pool or when Derek Jeter was coming to the plate. No, but inevitably, certain issues intersect with sports. Anyone who's even vaguely aware of the history of it knows that that's true. And when that happens, somebody has to address it, and that somebody should be the host, not the person who's calling the action, should be the host, and it should be done judiciously, and I think that's what I did over the years. And I think also people got confused if I'm asked to be on CNN and talk about some of these issues, that's not during the game. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there at 9 o'clock in the morning with Allison Camerata and John Berman. You know, it's not the same thing. But I did feel that there were times when these issues intersected. It's become obvious this past year, but there have always been occasions when it should be addressed. It's impossible to have an Olympics without some political overtones. How can you have an Olympics in Sochi and not talk about Vladimir Putin and not talk about the strong suspicions that the Russians were cheating with drugs? How can you have an Olympics in China and not talk about China's human rights abuses and the fact that there's no free press in China? How can the Israeli delegation come in London on the 40th anniversary of the Munich terrorist tragedy, when the Israeli athletes and coaches were slain, and the IOC refuses to acknowledge it in any formal way? Somebody's got to say that. So when the Israeli delegation comes in, instead of the boilerplate, here's the flag bearer and here's somebody who might be able to win a medal in whatever event, I mentioned that, but not during the event.
No, I understand the context. And listen, I think you did a great service by raising those points, because, you know, sports is not an island. And there are real life issues. You raised on Sunday Night Football after a player was involved in a murder suicide about the availability of guns.
Yeah, you know, David, that's one that if I could have a mulligan on it, I wish I could have it back. What I said and what I intended has been misrepresented. There are people out there who think that if I could, I would revoke the Second Amendment, take their guns away. For the record, no. If you need to use a gun to protect your home and family, that's your right, and in many situations, it might be the right thing to do. My point was about a gun culture in sports, which definitely exists. And prior to that time, Sports Illustrated, ESPN, and the USA Today had all done pieces about a gun culture in sports. And if you were to Google athletes and guns, you'd find a long list of tragedies, criminality, and folly associated with athletes and guns. And you'd be hard-pressed to come up with one instance where a prominent athlete used a gun to turn a dangerous situation around for the better, where you said to yourself, thank goodness he had a gun. Could it happen in theory? Of course. Has it happened in society? Yes. And that's a good thing. But that was the point I was trying to make. And I did not do it as well as I would like to think I usually do. I took it for granted that the audience would understand my point, and I didn't fully appreciate how volatile the issue was. And in retrospect, I wish that I had said, whenever tragedy strikes in sports, we hear the hollow cliche, well, that really puts it all in perspective. But that perspective disappears in about 5 minutes. If we're really searching for some perspective here, then we ought to take this as an opportunity to talk about domestic violence, to talk about the effects of football.
Yeah, well, I want to stop right there, because you also very strikingly spoke out about the impact of football on the brains of the athletes who participate, and basically walked away from the game.
Yeah.
I think almost a historic event, because you were so associated with Sunday Night Football. And so talk about that.
I was becoming increasingly uncomfortable with football. There's a history here. In the early 90s, after having stood on the sideline during games, and what you see and hear on the sidelines about the contact on every play and the kind of celebration of violence, I just became uncomfortable with it. Baseball and basketball have always been my favorite sports. But I grew up as a football fan. Y.A. Tittle and those Giants of Frank Gifford and company, they were my team. But as I got closer and closer to it, even though I recognized that many of the finest people I met in sports, players, coaches, people associated with the game, were football people, I just felt uncomfortable. And I asked Dick Ebersol, my friend and patron who ran NBC Sports, if I could step aside from football after the 93 season. And he said yes, and I did. Okay, now fast forward, and NBC gets football back, beginning with the 2006 season with Sunday Night Football. And Dick, who had done so much for me personally and professionally, it meant a lot to him to put together what he called his Mount Rushmore. They were bringing Al Michaels and John Madden over from ABC, and he wanted me and Chris Collinsworth in the studio. And it was so important to him, and there were a variety of personal factors involved. And I said, okay, I'll do it. But my misgivings grew. But NBC allowed me for a long time to occasionally address some of these issues. I addressed the concussion thing way before it reached critical mass in the public mind. There were at least a half dozen times over the years where at halftime, even though it's only a couple of minutes, that's the largest audience on all of primetime television, I was able to address those things. But then as it got past 2012, 2013, I realized that NBC was more and more uncomfortable with that. After all, football wasn't just the most important thing sports-wise. It was the most important entertainment entity to the entire network and to every network. And it just, I couldn't reconcile my position there. I realized that their presentation was fabulous. Sunday Night Football, Al Michaels, and now Chris Collinsworth, and the way it's produced and directed, it's the finest sports presentation on television. But I just felt like I couldn't make a wholehearted contribution to it as I once had. And, you know, I'd been around it a long time, and I'd also hosted a dozen Olympics, and I just felt it was time, before I reached a point of diminishing returns, to step aside from it. And once I did, then I was even freer to express myself about some of these things.
You talk about boxing. That Do you feel the same way about that?
Yeah, in retrospect, yes. I mean, I was never closely associated with the coverage of boxing. I hosted a few things like 20 years ago or so for HBO. And you can't help but think back to some of the epic fights and how interesting they were, and a certain kind of athletic courage was involved. We talked about Frazier and Ali.
Yeah, listen, I was right there with you.
But, you know, here's the thing with boxing. Okay?
Look at what happened to Ali.
Right. Look what happened to Ali. Look what happened to Joe Frazier at the end of his career, and Jerry Quarry. There's no denying what it is. On the other hand, the participants get into it, and we know exactly what it is. Defend yourself at all times. I think there are still some people who are in a state of denial about what football too often is to too many of its participants.
Bob, finally, in the interest of plumbing your candor, the president has intervened. I mean, the Colin Kaepernick story became what it was because the president of the United States, then a candidate, was running and decided to exploit it at a rally in Alabama during that
campaign.
Well,
he was already president. He was already president. It was 2017.
Oh, was it? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So he decided to exploit that issue at a rally, and it became a thing for him. And even now, he tweets that the NFL ratings are down because players are protesting and so on. He's commenting on the NBA players and their protests and so on. Tell me what his role is in all of this, and I know you have strong feelings about him.
Yeah. Isn't it ironic when people say, stick to sports, which means in almost every instance, stick to sports unless you're saying something I agree with and want to hear. The person, as you mentioned, who really politicized this was the president of the United States, who has the larger forum, the larger megaphone. It's ironic that Fox News, after telling everybody who says something that they don't want to hear, to shut up and sing or shut up and dribble, if you are in line with their positions, whether you're John Voight, a fine actor, or you're Lou Holtz or Bob Knight or Kurt Schilling, you're welcome on Fox. The microphone is yours, and that is their right. There's nothing wrong with that. But where's the principle here? Where's the consistent principle? Shut up and dribble. Shut up and broadcast the game because you're saying something I don't want to hear. But if you are saying what I want to hear, the door is open. Come on in. But yeah, look, we know what Trump does. Trump seizes any opportunity to please his base. But his base, you're the expert here more than I, his base is not expanding. We'll see what happens on November 3rd, but his base is not expanding. And more it becomes clear that his entire presidency has been a daily soap opera about his psychology. And I don't think most Americans believe that that's what they want in a president of the United States. The president of the United States should be psychologically, emotionally, intellectually, and morally appropriate for the position. That doesn't, we're not talking about policy here. We're talking, that could be true of a Republican, that could be true of a Democrat. You take a look at the current occupant of the White House, and unless you're in some state of cognitive dissonance, if you can say that this president is intellectually, psychologically, emotionally, and morally an example of what you look for in a president, well, you got me on that. I have no idea where you're coming from on that.
When he did the Kaepernick thing, when he invoked that to try and provoke, it did have an impact.
Yes.
On the NFL, and the NFL quickly sort of retreated on that. So it's not immaterial what a president says matters, and the almighty dollar spoke to the league, and the league did not. They're now saying they're now more responsive to the concerns of their players. They weren't then.
Yeah, they've done a 180, and Roger Goodell made it plain. He flatly went on camera and made it plain. Said we should have listened to the players, et cetera, et cetera. But as we talked about at the beginning of our conversation here, it's a tightrope walk for all the leagues, but especially the NFL and the NBA, where the overwhelming majority of players are black. You want to be sensitive to these concerns and to these legitimate issues, and you want to show respect for players using their visibility and platform. And in many cases, you want to facilitate that. But is the right way to do that and the most effective way to do that going forward, having it be front and center during the games themselves? I think the evidence of that is that outside of this moment in time, which is unique, that going forward, they've got to thread that needle in a somewhat different way.
Bob Costas, you're a living legend. I've enjoyed listening to you over the years and appreciate hearing you now on CNN and elsewhere. Great to be with you, and look
Thank
forward
you,
to
David.
Seeing you
it's
down
a real,
the line.
A real pleasure to be with you too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.